Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Now, I'm joined now by Sinead Burke, who is a teacher. One of her portfolio of talents, also a writer, a fashionista, a business person, CEO of the accessibility consultancy Tilting the Lens. Welcome, Sinead.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
And Sinead, you've chosen five pieces of music for us that have meant something to you.
Yes.
In your life. You've been busy since we last spoke. You're on the cover of Vogue again, working with Gucci a lot. You're in a gender equality campaign for them as well. But we saw on your out of office, your email out of office while you were on annual leave, that you said you might knit a hat. Did you get a chance to knit a hat in the midst of
all this? I did. I'm disappointed that I didn't bring one with me for you today, but you'll have to give me the measurements of one's head. I learned how to knit actually in school. It's part of the primary school curriculum within art.
There you go. You got something useful out of education. Yeah,
lots. And I like it because it's a thing that I have to be very focused for. It's like almost an act of mindfulness. I knit it on a round needle. I have the pattern kind of learned off by heart, but still, if I'm in conversation with somebody or scrolling something on my phone, I drop a stitch. And I am not a perfectionist in all aspects of my life, but I do like a hat without a drop stitch. So it makes sure that I concentrate and focus.
So you can't do it. If you're knitting, you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's interesting.
I'm not sure if it's a good or a bad thing, but it's
no,
a real moment of focus.
Thing, doesn't it mean? I think it's flow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is music important to you?
I love music. I actually studied music in school for the leave insert. And I think music has always been something that's been part of my house at home. It was something that my parents always loved. I think more and more I find opportunities for music to either be on in the background. I think it's a soundtrack for the good and the most challenging moments of your life. And I think often music can communicate things that you don't have words for, or that you're feeling something and it resonates. I think we are living in a moment where we've never had more access to music, and that is both challenging for the music industry, but also a great opportunity to be exposed to new things and new voices.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. I think we all listen to a much broader range of music than we ever did when we had to invest so much. And speaking of a broad range now, so your first choice is Simon and Garfunkel, The Sound of Silence. Why that?
So you were sharing at the beginning that I'm a teacher by training. So if we think about the Leaving Cert and the CAO, I did mine and I had one choice on my CAO form. I wanted to go to Cloche de Wirra, which is now Merino Institute of Education, to study to be a primary school teacher. And I loved it. I think the classroom is a microcosm of wider society. Now, I have a physical disability. I'm a little person, so I stand at the height of 3 feet 5 inches tall. And in many ways, when I began my career as a teacher, it was very obvious to me that the classroom wasn't designed for me. When I went through school as a student, I had a special needs assistant. I had brilliant staff members who were so supportive in terms of the teacher and the principal for my own education. And then I became a teacher and it became very obvious that I couldn't reach the light switches, showing my age, but I also couldn't reach the blackboard. They're now technology based. They're not actually using chalk these days.
Okay.
And I was teaching in the inner city. I had 6 class boys. And I was teaching through a PowerPoint presentation, and what I noticed was in between lessons that if I had to exit out of one PowerPoint presentation and move to the next, that it took about 90 seconds for that technology to work, which if anybody has 12 or 13 year old children is just the amount of time that is required to cause a bit of chaos. And in that classroom, you know, when we think about the classroom, often what's recommended for teachers is create a merit system, create maybe gold stars or stickers. The children, I thought, had no interest in gold stars and stickers, but they did like music. So I hooked up my Spotify account to my projector and my laptop. And at the end of every lesson, I would give a shopping trolley token to somebody who had made a big effort or asked an interesting question or who just took the time to maybe mentor somebody else in the classroom. And they only listened to it for about 90 seconds. Of course, everything didn't have swear words. There was a level of oversight on it. And I think maybe for the
person who got the shopping
token got to pick a song. So we listened to probably Calvin Harris and Ed Sheeran for the first 3 weeks because everybody was trying to prove how cool they are. And one of the boys who I suppose often demonstrated some of the most challenging behavior in the classroom, he came up to me one day and he said, "When I win the jukebox, I want to play Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel." This was a 12-year-old. And I said, "Amazing. How do you know that song?" And he said, "It's my dad's favorite song. We listen to it all the time at home." I said, brilliant. A couple of days later, he won the jukebox and he asked, can you play that song? It started. The rest of the boys in the class kind of raised their eyebrows as if to say, what is this? There's no electronic beat.
Yeah.
And at the end of, there was silence in the room. And at the end of the song, I asked him to explain how and why he picked that. And he said that, you know, it came from home. And the next song that was asked for was Aslan. The next was Thin Lizzy.
Okay.
And,
okay.
You know, I taught in what is considered a desh band school. And so often there was a disconnect within the education system between home and school. This became an amazing way for children to understand the lived experience and the expertise of their own parents and to go home and have a conversation, say, when you were my age, what did you listen to? And it all began because I couldn't reach the blackboard.
Okay, I love it. Simon and Garfunkel,
Sound of Silence.
In restless
dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw.
Yeah, you see some music. It's universal. You can imagine that connecting everybody, can't you? Going back to the classroom, Sinead, and the accessibility. So the work you're doing with Gucci at the moment,
yeah,
is kind of is related to what you experience in the classroom. There is it. It's similar philosophy.
Yeah, I think from the earliest of ages, I realised that I live in a world that's not designed for me. And I think in many ways it's easy look to the tables and the chairs or not having ramp access. But actually that underpins so much of how society is built, whether that's policies or mindsets. And my career started in classrooms but has transformed and changed, but it's still very much about education. And so much is because we don't know what we don't know. And how do we bring hearts and minds and people to have an understanding that we can all be disabled at one point in our lives. And that's not something to fear, but to understand is just part of the human life cycle. And part of the work that I do now with Tilting the Lens and one of the organizations that we work with, like Gucci, is to support them in thinking about how can accessibility be implemented in their organization to think about the people that they can employ, the products that they can create, the people who can come through their doors for the first time. And whether that is about retail accessibility, whether that's about the website, accessibility kind of is this branch that stems into so many things that I think for too long has been overlooked or not given the prioritization it deserves.
And it's interesting, presumably they don't have you there for the good of their health or because they want to do good or anything. I mean, they're doing good and you're doing good with them, but you're saying to them, you can expand your market here. You can expand your customer base.
Well, yeah. What Forbes says is that organizations that prioritize accessibility between now and 2030, there's about $10 billion in design spending going to be prioritized to those organizations. There is data points and statistics out there about the spending power of disabled customers along with their family and friends. But I think it's also important to acknowledge that in this country and globally, the average statistic of unemployment of disabled people mm-hmm. is between 50 and 75%. And there is so much work that needs to be done in order to create that space. There's a great quote that I love by an architect called Simone de Gale, and she talks about it's not that disabled people didn't exist, but that the buildings were inaccessible. Now, you can take the word buildings out and think of it as a policy, think of it as a radio station or studio. You know, if there wasn't a transcript for this conversation, deaf audiences may not be able to engage, for example. So how do we constantly think about moving the dial to create better organizations and systems and businesses?
Okay. Next song you picked is RuPaul, Supermodel, you Better Work. Why this?
You know, much like education, I think fashion has been such an important part of my life. Fundamentally, again, I think because I was disabled. You know, my father's a little person and he is amazing in so many ways. But he was not interested in fashion when I was growing up. And he kind of said, you know, just wear navy and black and figure it out. And for me, fashion became this powerful vehicle to communicate who I was, how I was feeling. And yet still, there wasn't enough representation or availability. I got to be on the cover of Vogue in 2019 as part of the Forces for Change issue. And that moment was important. It was important for me personally. It was the first time a little person was on the cover of any Vogue magazine ever. But the reality is, when it's the first, you have to make sure that you're not the last. And being the exception is potentially something to be celebrated, but actually the real opportunity and obligation more often is to create a pathway for more people to be included. So in March of this year, we got to participate and got to partner with British Vogue and Edward Enninful, who's the editor-in-chief there, for the May 2023 issue about reframing fashion, where for the first time, five disabled people were on the cover of the magazine, a cover each. There was 19 disabled people inside. Even more, the issue itself was available in Braille and in an audio version for the first time, and that is a continuous commitment they're making in every subsequent British Vogue issue for the next 12 months. So being able to see fashion as a vehicle that still for many is financially inaccessible and unaffordable. There are still many challenges with the issue regards to fast fashion, supply chain, how it speaks to people, body dysmorphia, and the way in which certain people are only represented in a certain way. And yet still, there is an opportunity, I think, because we all wear clothes, to really use it as a vehicle to move the dial.
And part of the reason, I think, isn't it that you were pushing an open door with Edward Enninful, is that people might not realise this, but he would identify as a disabled person.
Yeah, so Edward wrote a book, and in it he spoke about his blood condition, his eye condition. But actually it was when we were having conversations around this issue himself that actually he chose for the first time to self-identify as disabled. And I think what's important about that, what we know is that in terms of the disabled population, 70% of people acquire their disability. We also know that people go on their own journey with the language of disability. Some people don't feel disabled enough. Some people feel that the language of disability is characterized by a physical disability, that if one has anxiety, maybe that's not enough to self-identify as disabled. Okay. And I think that is framed by how we perceive disability in society. So for him to take a moment and, you know, in the position that he is in as editor-in-chief at British Vogue, to be saying, I am a disabled person, that doesn't make me less. It's fundamental to who I am. And it shapes the process by which I do my work and how I experience the world, is incredibly powerful, because I think of the many people who would love to see themselves in that position and now understand that whilst there's still many barriers in place, somebody else has done it.
Okay. And fashion, also great fun. RuPaul, supermodel, you better work. In terms of RuPaul, people might not realise this, but you kind of have roots in the gay scene in Dublin, don't you?
I'm just thinking of the people who are in their car or who are in their kitchen and were not expecting RuPaul on Radio 1 before midday. What a gift. I hope you add it to your playlist. Yes, I think, you know, we talked earlier about me training to be a teacher and going out and socialising in the city at nighttime used to be, and still in many ways, was incredibly difficult for me. I would go, you know, like you would as a college student, out to a nightclub or to a pub, and how other people used to interact with me just made me feel so unsafe. I would be dancing with friends and somebody would pick me up and throw me in the air, or they would behave lewdly, and it made me want to opt out of those social engagements. I had some amazing friends who were drag queens, Veda and Davida Devine and Panty and Shirley Temple Bar. And they said, why don't you come to the George one night? And I had never been. And it was amazing in that moment to be able to be in a space where I think lots of people had been made to feel other or different, was this incredible unifying experience. And just that notion of being able to be safe was so important to me. And it made me enter Alternative Miss Ireland in 2012. It was this competition that had existed for almost 25 years in the city. It had, in its most recent era, taken place in the Olympia Theatre. It was a fundraiser for HIV and AIDS. And I entered and retold the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but from my perspective. So I stood on a 4-foot platform. There was this wonderful old fairy tale narration. The Seven Dwarfs were all average height and non-disabled. They ripped my long skirt, lifted me down. We did full choreography to pop music. My mother, dressed as the Wicked Queen, came out to Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You. My father was dressed as Prince Charming. There was a glass coffin involved. And it was just an incredible experience. I had the great privilege of winning that year and becoming the last one ever. So the Alternative Miss Ireland Emeritus. And so many extraordinary people in Irish society have come through that process. If I think about the current director of the Project Arts Centre, Catherine Lynch, Shirley Temple Bar herself, there's so many people who've come through that process. But for me, it was this extraordinary feeling of acceptance and community and pride.
And I note from your social media profiles now, you now identify as queer. Recently that you started being more public about that?
Yeah, so, you know, we talked a couple of minutes ago around people being on their own journey with language and identity. I think in many ways, you know, I believe in intersectionality, in the way in which one identity overlaps each other, and none of us are just one thing, we're many things. And I think, like how many people potentially come on a journey with acceptance of their own disability and discovery of it, I came through that with my own sexuality. And I think even now I am reading all of the books, listening to all of the podcasts. The Transgender Issue by Sean Fay is excellent. Would also recommend Panty's book and memoir. And I think even coming to terms...
You have a whole other culture you have to join up on now, basically. A whole other identity you have to get the antecedents for.
But I think it's just even becoming more comfortable. You know, if I think around the language of bisexuality, that makes assumptions around how many genders there are rather than any gender. So it's something that I have become more vocal about, purely because if I think again and reflect back to disability, though they are not the same thing, it means so much, I think, to other people for that conversation to be public. But I'm still learning.
Yeah, aren't we all? Come here, there was a thing I wanted to ask you, right?
Oh.
And look, now, this is a bit heavy for a
mainstream
daytime radio show, but you know what?
We've just done RuPaul. Now's the time.
I think we can pull this off, right? And our listeners are intelligent people. So I saw you in a gender equality campaign for Gucci.
Oh, yes.
Julia Roberts, Annie Lennox, those kind of people, Sinead Burke. Now, you made a video for it, and I could have been misunderstanding this, but you say in it that progress for too long has been in silos of disability, sexuality, race.
Yeah.
And then I think, but is it not the way of things that, you know, individual kind of communities have to fight for their own rights? But you seem to be saying, are you saying we need to move beyond the silos of identity politics? Is there a new wave of thinking coming in on this?
It comes back to that notion of intersectionality. So that's a theory of practice by a woman called Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw. And the idea of it is that we are not just one thing. So I think the challenge of looking to solutions based on one identity individually means that those who have historically been most excluded continue to be so. So let's take the Vogue issue, for example. Erin Rose Phillip was on the cover of that issue. She identifies as a black trans disabled woman. And if we only ever speak to identity in silos, there is a great possibility that Erin is left out of so many conversations or places that she's in, because depending on the day, depending on the environment, different things impact her in terms of those challenges or those barriers. Or if we look to Dr. Rosaline McDonough, who was also in the Vogue issue, who is an amazing Irish traveller and disabled woman and writer and playwright, and her work is extraordinary. You know, not to speak for her, nor would I dare, but even to speak for myself. Some days my greatest challenge is the fact that I'm disabled. Some days my greatest challenge is the fact that I'm a woman. Some days my greatest challenge is the fact that I'm Irish and people can't pronounce my name.
Okay.
And, you know, there's easy ways to figure that out.
Have we got too hung up, so as a broader society, on these individual identities? Because I think a lot of people would think it would be nice if we could move past so much of a focus on it.
I think there's always a balance. So I think sometimes people say, for example, well, why don't we just treat people as humans?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who would often say to me, Sinead, I don't see you as a little person. And they mean that as a compliment.
Okay. Yeah.
Because they are a sighted person, and what they're trying to share with me is, I see you as more than a little person. Which in turn, what they're meaning is that being a little person is less.
Yeah, what's wrong with being a little person? Yeah,
and actually, yeah. By not seeing me as a little person, they then don't put anything in place to help me get into their apartment or to get around the place. So I think it's about finding the opportunities where we can have, I suppose, processes and ways of working that reflect the different barriers that exist for the ways in which different identities overlap. But I think, you know, if we look to the corporate environment, lots of organizations will say, you know, we're going to increase our gender representation. By 2040, we're going to have 50-50. But 50-50 of what? How and when do disabled women show up? How and when do trans men show up? And I think while that sounds really complicated, and I think while the solution then might be, well, let's just do nothing, I think it's more about just having a bit of nuance to the conversation and dialogue,
okay.
And more often making sure there's as many different people in the room as possible.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you simplified it at the end there. It's hard stuff, but I do feel, I'm sensing that this is where this conversation is going, is it? And people are hearing, I think you're ahead of us all in terms of all these issues. So we're going to have to romp through the rest of the music now, because we do want to get the rest of the music in. So your next choice, OMD and Enola Gay. I believe it was this or Joe Dolan. Yeah?
It was this or Joe Dolan, but I was conscious that the mix from Simon and Garfunkel to RuPaul to Joe Dolan might have been quite a lot before midday. So this is OMD, Enola Gay. As I shared earlier, music has always been such a common thing in our house. You know, my parents found and thought that music was something to be passed down and was a piece of education even of itself. Like that, the music that was often played at home was Bronski Beat, OMD, a bit of Joe Dolan. You know, my grandfather is, on my father's side, is Irish. He moved to the UK, and with that he brought the Irish music with him. And then when my dad came back, there was this familial love with things like Joe Dolan and others. But OMD is one of those songs that I think it doesn't matter where you are, if you're in your car, if you're at home, you can't help but like tap your feet or tap your fingers or, yeah, just think of it differently when you listen to the lyrics.
Yeah, and the fact that you got this from your parents also reminds me I'm kind of old enough to be your father. OMD and Enola Gay. OMD and Enola Gay, that's Sinead Burke's third choice of music today. And, you know, we could get into this now. I could start telling you as an old person how that seems like throwaway pop now, but how way ahead of their time so many of those
bomb.
British electronic yeah. bands were. But we will move on and we'll spare everyone that. Sinead O'Connor, He Moved Through the Fair is your next
yeah.
choice. Is Sinead an important person for you?
I was born in 1990, and that was the year that Nothing Compares to You came out. Now, of course, I have no memory of that, but we were talking earlier around, I've been fortunate to travel quite a bit with work and with life, and I think often when people see a name like Sinead written down, that if they've no familiarity with it, when I would travel, often people would say, ah, like Sinead
yeah,
O'Connor.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've just come from a song about an atomic bomb and RuPaul looking to, you know, self-pride and self-efficacy. And I think what's been so contemplative this year with Sinead's passing is seeing the many ways in which quietly and very loudly she made an enormous difference to so many people. You know, I saw things on the internet where she donated makeup to organisations that were without and needed them. And, you know, these are just small stories. And I think there's lots to be learned around her work beyond music and absolutely within it. But I remember singing this song when I was in school. We learned the more original version of it, and listening to He Moved Through the Fair, changing the gender pronouns. It's really poignant.
Yeah, here's Sinead. Sinead O'Connor, He Moved Through the Fair. That's Sinead Burke's fourth choice. And then we really, I'm sorry for rushing us now at the end, but we did include a major sociological symposium in the middle. So your last choice is the Gloaming, who I think of them as the ghosts of traditional music. Yeah. It's ghost music echoing down the years. Saura Saura, why did you pick this?
So it's the direct translation of Summer, Summer, though I think it's really haunting in its beauty. This is the piece of music that I turn to in good and I think even more in challenging moments. I think if you are a person who is advocating for change in small and big ways, or, you know, advocating on behalf of others, it takes a toll. And this is one of the things that I almost use as a resource to root myself into the ground, to take a deep breath, and to just, yeah, remember that, as was talked about earlier, the world is good and kind and change is happening.
Yeah, okay. That's as good a point to end as any. Sinead Burke, CEO of accessibility consultancy Tilting the Lens. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to see you again. And we'll go into the break with this, The Gloaming and Saura Saura. Thanks, Sinead.
Quill in the skull is thrown a square from Hogamer Fane and Sauralin. On Fween Shook Legal Bale on Hogamer Fane and Sauralin. Saura, Saura, Bangin' and Mona. Hogamer Fane and Sauralin. Saura Breed and Nonin Legal. Hogamer Fane and Sauralin.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.